You know, there's a form of art that I discovered a few years ago, and it's kind of been a helpful framework for me as I've looked at different situations, and so I want to introduce it to you. I think we all know the normal way of doing art. You take a white piece of paper and you use your pen or your paint or whatever device you have, and whatever you draw, that's the piece of art. But there's also this other piece of art where instead of drawing a line of what's going to represent the picture, you fill in the white with black, and whatever is left over is the picture that you're trying to communicate. And why that's a helpful framework is it helps us to realize that knowing about something is both knowing what something is, but also knowing what something is not. You may find somebody in a situation where they say, well, I don't know what that is. And if you can properly describe what it is not, you actually end up with a pretty good picture that's left over of exactly what something is. And that seems to be a model or a method that's used commonly in the New Testament. Look, for example, at 1 Corinthians 13:4. Love is patient, love is kind, love is not envious or boastful or arrogant. You see, we're going to tell you both what it is, but we're also going to help you understand what it is not. I think 2 Timothy 2:22 does a very similar thing when he says, shun youthful passions and pursue righteousness, faith, love, and peace. So you see, it's not this, but it is this that we are to pursue. I think it's a very similar model as Galatians 5:19, where Paul talks about the works of the flesh, and he describes those things as this is not the Christian life. But then he goes on in a few verses later to say it is, and here's the fruits of the Spirit. We get a picture of what is not and what is. When Paul talks about humility in Philippians chapter 2, verses 1 through 11, what he does is he helps us to do this same process by saying what it is and also what it's not. So here's verses 3 through 4. Do nothing from selfish ambition or conceit, but in humility regard others as better than yourselves. Let each of you look not to your own interests, but to the interests of others. You see what humility is not? Humility is not selfish ambition. Humility is not conceit. But humility is regarding others as better than yourselves. It is not looking to your own interest, but it is looking to the interest of others. And as we put these things together, we start to get a clearer picture of exactly what humility is. And so we're kind of working our way through a series called The Person in the Mirror, Pride, Humility, and Self-Esteem. And of course, the focus is to highlight humility. But what I want us to do this morning is to talk a little bit about pride, with the understanding that the more we understand about pride, the better we actually get a picture of what humility really looks like. So we start with the question, what is pride? And I think if you think about the ways that we use it in our language, that it's really a really broad, really diverse sort of word. I mean, when we're in church and we hear the word pride, we think that we know what we're supposed to do. We cross our hands and we just look at pride. But there are ways we use it, which that's not the case. Think about these examples. There's a kind of a pride you feel when your child encounters a challenge in life and they keep pressing on, and mom or dad will then say to that child, what? I'm proud of you. There's a kind of a pride that you might feel being a citizen as a part of a country. You might say, I'm proud to be an American. There's a kind of a pride you feel when you accomplish or you do something that you didn't even know you were able to do, and you finished it and you look and you say, wow, I did that. I feel proud. There's the kind of a pride you feel when you win first place in an art show or a performance or an athletic event. You feel proud of what you've accomplished. There is a kind of pride that is boastful, the kind that a coworker might say, I've never missed a quarterly goal in my life and I probably never will. That's a certain kind of pride. There's the kind of a pride with a person who says, either they say it or they infer, I know more than you, and I probably always will. And there's a kind of a pride where somebody insists on telling someone, did I mention that I'm a graduate of Yale University? So pride, as we use it, it has all these different contexts and this diverse use. And so I think that it forces us to ask or to recognize that there's a kind of a pride that we see as a virtue, that we would say that's a good thing to be proud of your children. But there's also a kind of a pride that we would say that's a vice. It's a bad thing that should be avoided. And so the question becomes, when we look at pride, is pride simply something that's an issue of dosing? Is it saying, as you look at pride, as long as there's a little bit of pride, that's okay. But if it grows too big, then we say, oh, that's an issue that we have to address. Or is the reality of the situation that there are actually two different kinds of pride, and they have to be dealt with and addressed in different ways? Maybe to illustrate these two differences, if you think about planting something in your garden and you put the seed in the garden and the plant grows and you say, as long as I keep this plant well trimmed, it's going to be a good plant. But if you don't trim it, it's going to start taking over your whole entire house. Is that what pride is like? Or is pride really looking at two seeds and saying, I can plant this seed and it's going to grow one type of fruit, or I can plant this seed and it's going to grow a different type of fruit? And I think as you look at the Bible, you begin to get the realization that pride is really two different types of things. There's a kind of a pride that is appropriate, and there's a kind of a pride that is very dangerous. So to help us to kind of notice this scripturally, I'm just going to read a few passages that I think talk about pride as a vice or as a bad thing or a negative thing. Proverbs 6, 16 and 17. There are six things that the Lord hates, seven that are an abomination to him. And the very first thing he lists is what? Haughty eyes. This way of looking at people through proudful eyes. Proverbs 11, 2. When pride comes, then comes disgrace. But wisdom is with the humble. Romans 12, 16. Live in harmony with one another. Do not be haughty, but associate with the lowly. Do not claim to be wiser than you are. Or 1 Corinthians 13, 4 that we've seen already, love is patient, love is kind. It is not envious or boastful or arrogant. And so we have this grouping of words of pride that we think this is a negative thing, a vice. But then here's another grouping of the word pride. 2 Corinthians 7, 4, I often boast about you. I have great pride in you. I am filled with consolations. I am overjoyed in all our affliction. Or Romans 15, 17, in Jesus Christ, then, I have reason to boast of my work in God. Hebrews 3, 6, Christ, however, was faithful over God's house as a son, and we are his house if we hold firm to the confidence and the pride that belongs to hope. Or Galatians 6, 14, all of us, all must test their own work, then that work, rather than their neighbor's work, will become a cause for pride. So we recognize and we try to figure out, well, what are we to do with this really broad use of the understanding and the concept of pride in the Bible? And I think it's helpful to think about being proud like we use last names. As many of you know, my last name is Ford, and I'm related to other groups of people who have the last name Ford. Hannah, Elizabeth, Caleb, Jerry. We are all a part of the Ford family. We share certain attributes and characteristics and DNA and all of those sorts of things. But just because I am related to some people who have the last name Ford does not mean I am related to all people who have the last name Ford. I am not related to Harrison Ford, or for those who've been around Montana for a while, David Ford, or Henry Ford. Those are all people who I share a name with, but they're not a part of my family. And so as we look at pride in the Bible, we realize that two family groups are represented. And they have certain attributes and characteristics that if we watch those, we can realize you belong in this family of the group of pride. And so the first family is kind of typified under the category, those with a preoccupation with self, which gets in the way of attending to God and others. I'm going to read that again. This is a kind of pride that has a preoccupation with self, which gets in the way of attending to God and others. And here's the kinds of words that end up in there. And I'm going to use the last name so you can see they're a family. There's independence pride, self-promotion pride, rivalry pride, selfish pride, ambitious pride, arrogant pride, boastful pride, haughty pride. All of these belong in a family together of a kind of negative or vice of pride. But there is another family group that is connected by a pride that is rooted in something that is associated in what God has done or what God is doing either in their life or in the life of others. That the source of what they're looking at is not their own accomplishment, but it is what God has been doing and what God is at work in. So we can see in our language today, we would have a kind of a pride that we would call God confidence and self-respect and dignity that is perfectly appropriate for all of us as Christians. But there's another grouping of pride of arrogance and domination and selfish ambition, self-love and boasting that clearly is outside of the realms of what Scripture explores. And I think this good form of pride is rooted in our worth and value as a human that is created in the image of God. This form of pride understands that what is good about us is good because God made us in that way. In fact, if you remember God's work of creation, God made the world and then he had an assessment of it. He said that it was good. God is a God who creates, and God is a God who makes, not because he's a proud God, but because out of love, he is compelled to do these things. And then he can stand back and look at what he made and he can say that it is good. And so I wonder, is there any way that we can build in such a way that it's not rooted in pride, but instead it's rooted in the fact that we are made in the image of God? Thinking about Exodus 31, verses 1 through 5, where the Lord said to Moses, "See, I have called by name Bezalel, son of Uri, son of Ur, of the tribe of Judah. And I have filled him with divine spirit, with ability, intelligence, and knowledge in every kind of craft, to devise artistic designs, to work in gold and silver, in cutting the stones for setting and carving the wood for every craft." And again, the context here is in the building of the tabernacle, and God has gifted these two guys. The next guy, Skip, because his name's so hard for me to pronounce, but he enables, he gives them the skill, he gives them the knowledge, he gives them what is necessary, and then they build the tabernacle, and as you get to the back of Exodus, it looks like they did a good job. But the good job is rooted not in their skills, not in their ability, but in the fact that God gave them that. And so they can look at the tabernacle, they can be proud of what they have built, they can say that it is good, but God ultimately gets the glory because we can build good things. But there is a time, isn't there, when building something is an act of pride? Building something comes out of your own ambition, your own sense of importance, your own desire to make a name for yourself. And so this, of course, is the case in the Tower of Babel, Genesis 11, 4. "Then they said, 'Come, let us build ourselves a city, a tower with its top to the heavens, and let us make a name for ourselves. Otherwise, we shall be scattered abroad upon the face of the whole earth.'" You can look at two different building projects, and the question is, what's underneath them? Here, they are trying to build a name for themselves. God created them in his image. They are valuable and worthwhile simply because they've been created. And yet that's not enough for them. They want their name and their reputation to go out around the whole world, that people will look at that tower and say, "These are special people. These are more significant people than others." And so the building is all about building up themselves, making a reputation for themselves. See, I think that if we look at these two words and we look at what motivates pride, it can go back to a word we introduced in our first sermon series about achieving and receiving. The irony is that all of us have enough things to be proud of in the fact that we're made in the image of God. We have dignity, we have self-respect there. But for some people, they have to go out and they have to achieve something that they think will make them significant. And yet already all of us are significant even before we've done a single thing. When I think about this idea of achieving something, I think of the story in Luke 15 of the prodigal son. I'm sure you've heard that first part there where the son goes off, he squanders everything, he goes back to the father, and the father has a party for him. And remember what happens to the older brother? This is in Luke 15, beginning verse 29. "The older brother answered his father, 'Listen, for all these years I have been working like a slave for you. I have never disobeyed your command. Yet you have never given me even a young goat that I might celebrate with my friends. But when this son of yours came back, who has devoured your property with prostitutes, you killed the fattened calf for him.' Then the father said to him, 'Son, you are always with me, and all that is mine is yours.'" And I want you to be sure you notice these two phrases. The first is the older son says, "I have been working like a slave for you." He said, I'm trying to accomplish or achieve something. I'm trying to make a name for myself in a way that you would look at that and you would reward my faithfulness with something good. And what does the Father say? He says, I'm always with you, and all that I have is already yours. He is trying to achieve something that he has already, in fact, received. And how often do we do that in our lives? That this sense of pride of, I want to make a name for myself. I want to build up something. I want to promote myself. That all this, we're hoping we'll get something from it. And if we just stop long enough, we'd realize we have everything we need already. See, I want to explore this kind of bad form of pride in a specific way that it expresses itself. It's a kind of arrogant, selfish, boastful pride. But the thing we need to know about this pride is that it's an exhausting major production that's intended to protect the real self that has never accepted the fact that the Father loves his or her imperfect self. When I did youth ministry, there was one of the kids in the youth group who clearly had a swagger about him. You know, walk around and have that walk. You know the walk I'm talking about, right? Like that sort of thing. He always wears his ball cap backwards. He'd show up at youth events and he'd have his driver's seat like all the way back. He's like, argh. And how we talk, you could just tell he's like, man, I'm tough stuff. I was not surprised at all a few years later when his mom said that his parents were divorcing, and she said his dad would belittle him and demean him, say all sorts of nasty things about him. And so what he had to do was he had to build a wall. He had to build something that we could look at and say, you're impressive. You're something significant. And so he acted in this way, building up this wall. See, pride builds a majestic and oppressive wall around the real self. And the whole hope, the whole effort is you'll be distracted by that wall. You'll be impressed by the wall, but you'll never ask who's really behind it. And people labor and build up walls. They want the reaction like the disciples had when they went to the temple, said, look, teacher, what massive stones and magnificent buildings. And they think, maybe if they see all of this excess pride I'm building out here, maybe they'll never even want to know who's really behind everything that they're building. See, in this way, pride is like a master magician. Magic is the art of misdirection. You know why magicians use those wands? Because they want you to look at the wand so that over here they'll do something else and you won't even know what they did. Pride is the very same. Pride is saying, I want you to look at this construct. I want you to look at all the bravado. I want you to look at all the ways that I'm acting and all the things that I'm saying. And I want you to look at all those things because I don't want you to look at me. Because if you see me, you will find out how small and meaningless and insignificant I think I really am. Richard Lovelace says it this way, much of what we call pride is actually not God-like self-admiration, but masked inferiority, insecurity, and deep self-loathing. Pride always has to put on some form of an external skin so that you will never see the true person. And because of that, maintaining that wall of pride is pretty exhausting work. You're always building the wall thicker. You're always building the wall higher. And all of it, again, is an effort to make sure they don't see the real you. So when you are living on the basis of this kind of pride, you never let your guard down. You never let anybody see you without your makeup on. You never admit failure. You never admit mistakes. You never say somebody else did something better. You can never do anything that doesn't promote an image of you being larger than life. And that's exhausting. It's exhausting to keep this up, this persona, this wall of pride. I think of the king in Babylon who Isaiah 14:13-14 said, you said in your heart, I will ascend to heaven. I will raise my throne above the stars. I will sit on the mount of assembly on the heights of Zaphron. I will attend to the tops of the clouds. I will make myself like the Most High. And the question becomes of the king of Babylon, when is high enough high enough? When is the glory ever enough? When are the applause ever enough? When are the crowds ever big enough? And the answer is, they're not. Because pride demands all of your attention to build this wall, to promote this person that you know as well as everyone else, that underneath it all, there's really nothing there. And I hear these words that the king of Babylon said, I hear echoed all over the place in our culture, in our world today. I hear echoed in the movie The Greatest Showman in the song Never Enough. All the stars, all the shine of 1,000 spotlights, all the stars we steal from the night sky will never be enough. Never be enough. Towers of gold are still too little. These hands could hold the world, but it'll never be enough. Never be enough. I hear the words of the King of Babylon echoed when I read this from General George S. Patton. I do not fear failure. I only feel the slowing up of the engine inside of me, which is pounding, saying, keep on going. Someone must be on the top. Why not you? And I hear the echo of the words of the King of Babylon when Madonna says this in an interview. I have an iron will, and all of my will always be to conquer some horrible feeling of inadequacy. I push past one spell of it and discover myself as a special human being. Then I get to another stage, and I think I'm mediocre and uninteresting. Again and again, my drive in life is from this horrible fear of being mediocre. And that's always pushing me, because even though I have become somebody, I still have to prove that I am somebody. My struggle has never ended, and it probably never will. And doesn't that just sound exhausting? To try to maintain this wall of pride, just so that nobody will see the real you. But there is a gospel hope. There is a gospel solution, and there is a gospel answer. What the gospel invites us to do is to put down the tools that you've been using to build that wall. The gospel is an invitation to stop trying to hide and protect who you really are. Remember after the first sin in Genesis 3, 9 through 10, but the Lord God called to the man and said to him, where are you? And he said, I heard the sound of you in the garden, and I was afraid because I was naked, and I hid myself. Don't we all have that fear that God might see us as we really are? And so what we do with God is we play hide and seek just like kids play hide and seek. And here's how kids play hide and seek. They cover their eyes, and then they think we can't see them. And don't we do that with God? We're going to find this place. We're going to build a wall that somehow we think is so big he can't see it. The reality is that God already sees us. God already knows. The wall doesn't hide God from anything about our true self. In fact, here's how Romans 5 describes what God sees when he looks at our true self. God saw us while we were weak, sick, and ungodly. God saw us while we were still sinners. God saw us while we were looking like his enemies. We didn't trick anyone. He knows exactly who we are. And for some of you, that probably sounds more like bad news. You mean the wall hasn't been working this whole time? I've been exhausting myself, trying to act like something, being big and tough, and the reality is that God knows exactly who I am. And here's what God did, knowing what he knew about you. Christ died for the ungodly. God proved his love for us when Christ died for us. And while we're yet enemies, he reconciled to God through the death of his son. That's good news. The good news is this, that God knows your true self, and he still loves you. He still cares for you. He still sees something that is valuable and worthwhile because you are made in his image. God knows our imperfection, our brokenness, our damage, and God says to all of that, yes, I will die for you too. And so the question and the invitation for us is, am I willing to step outside of the wall and just let the truth be known that I'm a sinner? That if you peeled it all back, what you'll find is someone who is hurting and someone who is broken. And you might say, it's one thing for God to be able to see behind the wall, but I'm not sure I want anyone else to see behind the wall. But I will let you know this. Anybody who is a living, professing Christian who's been baptized into the waters of baptism will say it first, I am a sinner. That's part of the whole process of coming out from outside the wall, of coming out of the hiding that we've done in the garden. is to say, God, I entrust my true self to you, and I believe that you will bring healing and redemption to me. And so the question really is, are you willing to entrust yourself to God? Because it is amazing what can happen to your life when all of your energy no longer is zapped by building the wall. And you'll realize there is a God who is glorious, who gives you value and worth. And you'll be able to then see that there are people who are hurting. People have needs. And rather than being so tired from maintaining your own life, you'll have something left to invest in others. And so if this morning you feel like you are ready to come out from the wall and to say, I am a sinner, we're going to sing a song in just a moment. Myself and some of the elders will be in the back. Just come back there and let us know. And what you will encounter is somebody who they themselves realize, behind all this, I'm just a sinner, saved by the grace of God. But before we sing that song, I do want to offer a word of blessing. May the Lord bless you and keep you. May the Lord make his face shine upon you and be gracious to you. May the Lord turn towards you and give you peace. Just remember that as we enter into a world that is building these huge facades about how great they are, we simply go with the assurance that we go with the love of God, with the grace of the Lord Jesus Christ, and with the fellowship of the Holy Spirit. If you'd like to respond in any way, come on back while we sing this next song together.